As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Mighty Manfred here. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Ronnie Barnett on our coolest conversations. He's a bass player in the Muffs, who have just issued their latest album, No Holiday. Sadly, its release comes on the heels of the passing of their dynamic and talented frontwoman, singer, guitar player, and songwriter, Kim Shattuck, who passed away earlier this month from complications due to ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. However, despite Kim's illness, the album was completed, and she had the satisfaction of knowing that it was finished as she had envisioned it. The album features the coolest song in the world, On My Own. So let's hear some of that now, and then I'll be back with Ronnie on the line for today's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and joining me today for our coolest conversations is Ronnie Barnett, bass player in the Muffs. Thanks for speaking with me today, Ronnie.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Right. Well, you know, normally instead of thanking somebody right at the outset, I'll ask a person how they're doing, but today I figured that that question is much more than part of a greeting given Kim's recent passing. So let me ask you now, how are you and how are you doing?
I'm okay. You know, even though it's been I've seen her through a long illness, and it was kind of inevitable this day would come. It's still a shock to me, and it still reverberates, and it will for a long time. She's so important in my life, and obviously not just being a bandmate for 29 years, but, you know, I've known her for a lot longer, and we have a history together. So she's been she's loomed very large in my life since 1986. So, yeah, and the response has just been overwhelming. All the tributes and press, and it's beyond anything. I knew it was a big deal, but it's great to see this response from all over the world. So, yeah, no, I'll be processing this for a long time to come.
Well, I first became aware of you guys. I was in Pensacola, Florida. I was playing a show there with the Woggles at a club called Sluggo's. I'm thinking that was 1991. Do you remember Sluggo's in Pensacola, Florida?
I think you just named the one club we ever played in Florida. Yeah, that sounds familiar. We played there in 95, but yeah, we only played Florida, one town, one time.
At the time, these folks, Terry and Nick, they ran it or owned it, and we crashed at their place after the gig, and the next day, I think this was Nick, he stuck your video of New Love in the VCR, because that's the time we were living in, and told me about how great you guys were, and watched the video, and I was just completely blown away for the song New Love. What a great song. And then for me, you know, a Pandora's fan who was disappointed by the later P-Days, to know that there were a couple of Pandoras in the band, and they were so terrific, was very heartening. So you're saying that was about 1995. When exactly did you guys form?
We formed in October 1990, so just 29 years this month, and I played our first show in January of 91. So that single would have been like late 91, probably November, something like that.
I wanted to say, when Kim joined the Pandoras,
her boyfriend at the time claimed that she could play bass in order to help her get the gig, which, when technically she didn't. So now, did you already play bass when you joined the Muffs, or was Kim just telling people that?
No, I played bass in two bands in high school, and then I kind of put it down, and I became a rock journalist in my hometown of Houston, and I thought that's what I would do. And what happened was me and Kim's friendship, our three-year friendship, turned into a romantic thing, and I dropped everything and moved to California. At that point, I'm not even sure she knew I played bass, but she had started writing songs on her four-track. She was not happy with that heavy metal direction of the Pandoras, just like you, and just like just about every member of their audience. They were not playing the big crowds out here at that point. And she found out I played bass. She kind of wanted to have her own band, as you know, or as everybody might not know, she didn't write songs in the Pandoras. So she stuck to all these songs, found out I played bass. We were talking about having our own band even while she was still in the Pandoras. I remember I played on a song on her four track, and we even auditioned a drummer named Murdoch. He's the lost member in the Muff story. I don't know where he is. I don't know any other. I don't know if that's his first name, last name, but we went to somewhere in Garden Grove, California, and played with him, and that didn't work out. But, you know, by the time she had quit the Pandoras, and I got to say, when she quit the Pandoras, I was like, what do you mean you quit the Pandoras? You can't quit the band. And she's like, no, I quit. We'll have our own band. And, you know, Melanie was our best friend at the time, and she had left the band a month before Kim, and picked up the guitar, and we had a set of songs, found a drummer, and it happened real quick.
Well, the new album, No Holiday, that came out a week ago on Friday, October the 18th, on Omnivore Records. Kim passed away on the 2nd of this month due to complications from ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. So she heard the album before her passing, right?
Oh yeah, she. We were still hoping that she would make it to see the actual day. But one thing is, she got to see the initial kind of good reaction to the record, because you know the press releases go out like 3 months before the releases these days, and she got to actually see the finished product. You know, she got to see the vinyl and the CD, and she. She died knowing that it was coming out and that it was getting a good response already. So we can take some solace in that.
Where did you record the album?
Well, the album, see, before it came out, when she was, you know, still being private, it was kind of being interpreted as an album of outtakes, but it's not an album of outtakes. Most of the album, the heart of the album, was written to be the next Muffs record. It's just when she got sick, she couldn't play guitar at that point, and then the illness moved really quick, and she wasn't going to be able to sing. So we basically dressed up her demos. We recorded drums and additional instruments to these acoustic demos that she had. Some had a little electric guitar, but we fleshed them out. She oversaw this. And there's also at least three songs that are fully recorded for our last record. And we're just left off for space reasons. They're really good songs. On My Own is one of those songs. So that's why the album kind of sounds like some songs sound fully finished and some sound a little acoustic-y and some of the vocals aren't quite as loud, because we wanted to keep as much of those things she recorded as we could. So I'm surprised how cohesive the record sounds. You know, it's you have lo-fi stuff next to fully produced stuff, but somehow it does sound cohesive.
And she still oversaw all that mixing and the overdubs.
She did. She sat in a chair in her room, and we were in a study in her house. She would communicate, do it again, or that note was bad, or, you know, sing it this way. She had to kind of get creative with her descriptions. But yeah, she oversaw everything, and she oversaw the mixing. I mean, the guy who mixed it, Evan, really did work a miracle to kind of make everything sound so great. Yeah, she was going through mixes for at least a couple of months back and forth with Evan. And she sequenced it. She did everything. So.
Well, she never publicly disclosed her ailment. I think you even mentioned that a moment ago. But you knew, obviously. How did you deal with that?
The best I could. I mean, I got to say, even though it was such a horrible illness and it was so hard to watch it progress, if anybody doesn't know what it is, look it up and you'll see. But you know what? She smiled. Anytime I visited her, of course, there were a couple of moments where it got kind of sad, but it was mainly laughter and smiling. And I saw it as my job to just tell funny stories and make her laugh. And she could, she could laugh, even though her whole body had, you know, shut down, she still could laugh and smile. And she still liked the same stuff. And she still had the machine that read her eyeball that spoke for her, say dirty jokes. And, and you know, she was still kind of, you'd walk in and the machine would say something dirty in a robot voice. And she would just smile, and she was still in there. That's kind of the heartbreaking thing about the disease. Your brain is still 100% on, whereas your body has failing you. So
tell me about Roy McDonald, your drummer for many years. What was his reaction when he found out? Did you guys both find out at the same time, or what was his reaction?
No, we did. She had gone through a few months of being misdiagnosed with things. Doctors thought it was a carpal tunnel at first, and then a nerve in her neck and stuff. But I remember, you know, ALS runs in Kim's family. You know, she had a couple family members suffer from it, so it was always a fear of hers. And I remember she texted me and Roy, and we all broke down, and yeah, that was a very heavy night.
It's just an incredible feat to me that Kim was not only able to complete your album, but she also had this whole side project thing with our very own Palmyra Delran, and you mentioned Melanie Vammen once was in the Muffs and was also with her in the Pandoras. They had the thing, the Coolies, their side project, that she's able to not only finish your album, she has this other thing going on where she's, you know, sorting through demos and sending it off to those ladies to work with. Describe to me Kim Shattuck as a force of nature.
Yeah, I mean, she stayed busy during the whole time. Yeah, she, besides dusting off those demos, she wrote lyrics for a couple of songs that the other girls wrote music to. She wrote lyrics on a song on the new Red Cross record. Who knows what else is stored in that machine? I know she, you know, she liked making playlists. She, you know, was a huge baseball fan. And yeah, she kept her mind occupied during all this. Thank God for that machine. Yeah, it really became a part of her.
Our coolest song in the world this week is On My Own, and at Kim's celebration of life, I wound up speaking to her mom, and her mother, with no prompting, told me about that song and said that Kim had brought her a four-track recorder with a demo of the song on it like years ago, and that Kim was real excited to play her the demo. And her mom said that after she heard this recording, this demo, she thought, well, maybe Kim will be able to make it as a songwriter after all. And then her mom went on to say, but the band didn't like the song, but it's finally on the new album. And now bear with me here. And so then I was speaking with Roy, drummer in the Muffs. And let's say again, Roy is a very lovely man. Don't you agree, Ronnie?
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely agree.
Okay, well, yeah. I want you to keep that love in your heart as I tell you that he completely sold you out. Because when I asked him why you guys didn't have that song on any earlier album, he said, oh, he wanted to and that you hadn't. Now, Ronnie, I have to say to you, thank you so much for standing your ground and not letting that track on any other album, because it's such a highlight as part of No Holiday. I mean, the music and the lyrics, her voice, the song sentiment, you know, this joy and this melancholy, this whole world of emotion and life squeezed into less than 4 minutes. Ronnie, thank you for letting this moment of brilliance find its time to shine.
I got to say, this is my plan the whole time.
An excellent plan, a perfect plan. So you mentioned that song being one of the ones that was completely done for the album. At what point was it completely done, you know, several years ago, and then you held on to it for this record, or when was that song actually recorded?
It was recorded for Whoopie Doo, and I want to, even if Roy says bad stuff about me, I think I'll say, I think it was Roy's idea to kind of bring that one back and do it. I could be wrong. It could have been Kim. It could have been both of them. But yeah, we recorded for Whoopie Doo. And again, Roy was heartbroken that it didn't make Whoopie Doo, as you'll be able to hear, people, because you're going to hear the song. It's not a second tier song or anything. It's a great song. And yeah, I got to say, if the early band, if we didn't embrace it, I don't really recall. It was probably just because we were started off as more of kind of roaring rock band, you know, even though we had a couple, you know, a few pop songs. I think it's probably why it got put on the back burner. It was probably just needed more rockers at that point.
Well, it certainly shines on this record. I mean, it just really stands out. And I just feel like, also given everything that has come to pass and her personality and her perseverance, you know, it speaks a lot to her personality. And I think it's just perfect. Did she ever share with you what prompted her to write this song specifically?
If she did, I forgot. gotten, you know, when she wrote this, she was still living at home. Maybe she, you know, was declaring some kind of independence or something, but I can't say. But yeah, like you said, I'm glad that we kept it, and I'm glad it's kind of a nice full circle thing to have a very early song that she wrote be on our very last record.
I agree. Did she ever reveal much about what prompted her to write different songs or their influences, or did she keep that pretty close to her vest?
She generally kept that kind of close to her vest. I mean, obviously there are songs she would write about people, and she would not be shy about telling us that, like, this song's about this person, or I don't like this person, so I wrote this song, Red Eyed Troll, about them, you know, that kind of thing. Sometimes it was obvious, yeah, sometimes it was not so obvious, but she was passionate, that's for sure.
Well, over the course of the 18 tracks on the album, there's, I think, just a wonderful range of melodies and feelings. A couple I want to point out here. Insane, which I could see like Dave Davies coming up with. To That Funny Place gives me a very zombies feeling. I could see Colin Blunstone singing that. So when you guys are traveling around, if you're all awake and you're listening to stuff in the van together, what was the world, what was the frame of music there for all three of you that you could share together?
See, that's a good distinction there, when we're all awake. Kim actually had a, I don't want to say narrow taste in music, but she liked what she liked. She liked that style of songwriting. So yeah, the common stuff in the van is stuff like Kinks and Zombies and Hermits. Kim loved Freddie and the Dreamers. And, you know, if you listen to basically any of our songs, it's basically songwriting like that, model after songwriting like that, that 60s style songwriting, just kind of maybe revved up a bit. And that's the stuff we would play because, as you say, when we're all awake, if me and Roy played something like ZZ Top, in the van, it would be nonstop chatter on how she hated it or how bad it was. And so me and Roy learned not to play that stuff. It just wasn't worth it while she was awake. And that said, there was even a point where, you know, we might play something like that. And then she would awaken and say, don't play that while I'm sleeping. It's going to seep into my songwriting. And I could just see Kim, you know, coming out with a song that sounds like Foghat, like a boogie rock song, just because it seeped into her songwriting. It did. That was Kim, though.
Freddie and the Dreamers there, and I think that kind of ties into another story from that, her celebration of life. And I think it was Hillary Burton of Honeychain was talking about her 3-year-old daughter, and they were watching the Muffs video of Really, Really Happy. And Hillary's daughter, you know, watched Kim in the video put her face in a birthday cake. And as a 3-year-old, that was just, you know, wildest, craziest, funniest thing ever. And then thought of Kim as Cake Face Lady. And then Hillary said, oh, we're going to go meet Cake Face Lady. And then the 3-year-old was getting a little overwhelmed because now she's going to meet her hero in person. And so Hillary went on to describe how disarming Kim was, and Kim introduced herself as Cake Face Lady and sat down next to the daughter on the couch, and then took her on a tour of the house. And they were in the bathroom a long time talking about toilets, and hearing about how she got along so well. The little girl reminds me, and this, the Freddie and the Dreamer thing ties into this too, about how her songs have got this childlike innocence. And in the album that's in the track Sky and Lucky Charms, where does this sort of childlike innocence come from? What accounts for that in her songwriting?
I'm not sure what accounts for it, but I can tell you that Kim never lost that. She always was that person. Like she never lost that childlike aspect to her personality. Kim was the same at age 54 as she was at age 18. I mean, she, the same things made her laugh, same things made her mad. And she was also sweet as pie like that, unless somebody was not nice to her, then they got the opposite. But yeah, her taking Hillary's daughter under her wing like that and talking about toilets and putting her face in a cake, I mean, that's pure Kim. I mean, I wouldn't doubt Kim's wearing like Mickey Mouse ears when she was doing it. You know, Kim never lost that childlike thing, for better or worse. So Kim did and said what she wanted to, you know, more than anybody that ever walked the earth. She didn't adhere to the norms. Like, you heard me talk about her attempting to have jobs. You know, it just didn't work out because Kim didn't understand why she had to kind of adhere to a format. You know, she did not like to be pinned down.
Oh, you know what? I, at the Celebration of Life, I remember you mentioning that. But why don't you share that with our listeners here?
Yeah, the one the one time Kim attempted to kind of have a job during our career, Roy's then newly married wife worked at a law firm and got Kim a job, kind of just helping. It was probably even part-time job, just kind of filing around the office. And early on, Kim went to lunch and she came back. She had taken a bit of a long lunch and they're like, Kim, you took 2 hours for lunch. And she said, but that's how long it took. And that sums up Kim. Like, she really didn't understand why that wasn't right. And really, like, that's how long the lunch took. So,
you know,
my lunch is.
Another funny thing that was stories that were shared, I'm hoping you can repeat here for us, is, you know, she liked doing prank calls a lot. And not just prank calls, but just sort of pranks in general. There were several stories about her writing letters to former managers. Do you recall any of those offhand?
Yeah, I mean, I got to say the heyday of that was the Pandora's days. You know, by the time we started our band, she was still doing the prank calls. But as far as the very elaborate ones, like with a letter to the manager talking about wanting to cast her in a commercial and how the deadline was 3 years from that the point of the letter. The heyday of that was definitely the Pandora's. And I got to say the Red Cross was very influential in that, too. They were kind of the kings of that. They were like pranking like Lucille Ball and stuff like that. So,
well, we don't have time to properly listen to, you know, as much of the albums I'd like to do. The only other track we can play right now is The Kids Have Gone Away. So tell me some about this song.
This song was kind of, well, as you'll be able to tell, it's very Who influenced. And Kim kind of came up with this chord progression and kind of wanted to be, this was different for us too. She wanted us to kind of collaborate as a band. So that song was kind of like arranged in the rehearsal studio, which is something we never did. Most of our songs were Kim arranged them within an inch of their life. Kids Have Gone Away, you know, Roy really took over on the drums too. That's why she gave him a co-songwriting credit on this. I got to say, this one was one of the tougher ones to kind of make sound decent because it was not recorded that well and her vocal was on a track with a loud guitar and we really had to fight to get that vocal as up as we got it and still wish it could be a little louder. But yeah, Kids Have Gone Away is perhaps the most collaborative band effort, for better or worse, that we ever had.
Ronnie, thanks so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I wouldn't get out of bed this early for anyone.
Without further ado, here are the Muffs off the new album No Holiday, telling us that the kids have gone away in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Have Gone Away. It's the Muffs here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and that track off the new album, No Holiday. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the Muffs bass player, Ronnie Barnett, for joining me on today's Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our segment. As always, you can find the most recent Coolest Conversations available on Mondays via any of your favorite podcast hosting websites. Remember to follow and subscribe. And I'm looking forward to chatting with another bass player next week. Yeah, I'll be speaking with Adam Lights Out Levine. He's the bass player in the L.A. bass band Prima Donna. That's your next Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it decide, baby, diamond ring.